Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on accepted for value or redemption and the straw man right after this. You know, in real estate transactions, we follow these three rules. It's called location, location, and location. Well, in criminal law, we follow three rules also when we're talking to the police or a government agent, and that is, don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and then shut up. Knowing what to say and when to say it, and what not to say, and who not to say it to, is summed up in this maxim of law. And that is, all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And that's why judges, in their opinions, oftentimes make short, terse statements like these. Listen to this first judge. He said, who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights? And he said that in a case called U.S. versus Dickerson. Now, you know, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of being a tax protester, wouldn't I? Now, listen to the second judge. He said, quote, you can and you must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment. And he said that in a case called Belknap versus United States. If I said something like that, I'd be accused of obstructing justice. Now listen to what this third judge has to say. He said, the constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and the farsighted. And he said that in Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. Remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Now, our school, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, is available on compact disc for home education. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? All right, we're talking about this thing of straw man. To some of you, that may sound like kind of a wild concept or idea. But there's a patriot movement out here. There's a process that people are subscribing to, and it's called redemption. And when people call here, they ask if I'm involved in it, or if I participate in it, or if I support it. And each and every time somebody calls, and I got to say, well, no. And then when I say no, then they want to know why. They want to know why. And the why is a whole lot larger explanation than I want to spend with each and every person that calls on the telephone, one at a time. So I thought, well, let me just put a few of these programs together and put it on the air and tell you, well, here's why. Now, I put a CD out some years back. I think it's two or three CDs. I kind of forget now. In answer to this some years back, Larry Beecraft wrote an article here. It's called Destroyed Arguments, and it's number 22 in his Destroyed Arguments treatise. And I thought, well, let's take Larry Beecraft. Now, he's an attorney. And he specializes in income tax defenses, criminal income tax cases. He's been doing that for years and years. I suppose he still is, unless he's retired. And he's pretty good at it. He's probably won more than he's lost. And he's pretty knowledgeable about income tax and income tax issues. He's a specialist in that area, criminal law. And this is part and parcel with income tax, because many times people will use this redemption and straw man idea, this theory, to defend themselves against income tax charges or driver's license charges or child support charges or, you know, you name it, and they'll bring this up and they'll bring this in. And when they do, they usually always lose. I don't know of a single one that's ever used this and won any case for any cause or reason. Now, there may be some out there that I don't know about, but even if there is, that doesn't make it a viable defense. It certainly doesn't make it a viable defense in all cases, in all subject matters. So, Beecraft came up with one of the stories in his article here, which is dealing with this thing of the birth certificate is not the basis for the creation of this credit in this country. Now, part of this straw man theory here is that your birth certificate is the connecting link here that ties you into the state. Now, I mentioned the other day, I said, you know, the birth certificate's wicked, terrible, awful, and evil, but that's not what it does. And so a lot of these patriot groups or patriot gurus or people in general, you know, they come up with these theories. Now, remember, this theory comes from a guy named Roger Elvick. Roger Elvick has been jailed several times on fraud. He goes out, he sells this. He's a patriot kind of guy. And he goes around and he sells these kinds of legal arguments and concepts. It's the way he makes his living. And then the people that buy these go into court and actually use it, and they're the ones that go to jail. They're the ones that go to prison. So let's take a look at the last two arguments that he has, in which he says there are six flaws to this argument, this redemption, straw man, birth certificate. In fact, I put down all the buzzwords. It's called accepted for value, redemption, straw man, UCC 1-207, redemption process, site drafts, affidavit of truth and commerce. And there's probably some more buzzwords out there that I've overlooked, that I've forgotten about, didn't think of. But they're all aimed at, depending upon what group you're in with now, they're all aimed at this concept, this idea that you have this connecting link with government. Well, you do have a connecting link with government through the birth certificate, citizenship, driver's license, marriage license, business licenses, and so on. No doubt about that. But that doesn't mean that redemption or straw man or these ideas, these theories, are the magic bullet or the magic panacea that's going to solve all your problems and get government off your backs. So we just completed flaw number four, that is, the 1935 Social Security Act did not create an account for everyone born in this country in the amount of $630,000. So, I told you about four guys that came down here. They all came down here to class practicing the straw man theory. And they're all four of them, their concept was that yes, and it does work, and they wanted me to show them what was wrong with it. And so I agreed to put them through my tax school. They did. When we got all through, I said, and I explained in detail to them why I thought that it was phony, why it was bogus. And this was before I had this treatise here from Larry Beecraft. If I'd had this, I would have said, hey, listen, let me tell you the story. But in their case, all four of them failed, which is what I thought was going to happen. But at the time, I didn't know why. I couldn't tell them why. I just said, this thing smacks of criminal activity to me. And as it played itself out, it did, in fact. Now, Beecraft is going to prove this negative. Remember I said, now, I'm not going to try to prove a negative, but Beecraft did. He said, not only doesn't it work, here's why it doesn't work. I wouldn't mind proving the positive, but trying to prove a negative, you know, it takes a lot of time, effort, and energy. Now, in flaw number five, we talk about Treasury direct accounts. The above named account is not the Treasury direct account. And he says, neither the original Social Security Act nor any amendment to it created an account known as the Treasury direct account. However, there is such an account established by Treasury for those who routinely purchase U.S. notes and bonds. A description of this account may be found at 31 CFR Part 357, and specifically 31 CFR Part 357.20. And those who assert that everyone has such an account know nothing about such accounts, and there's no public side or private side for these accounts. So depending upon who you're listening to, they will tell you that there's a private and a public side, and there's a Treasury direct account, and this account holds approximately $630,000, which was derived by the sale by government. Now, the sale of your birth certificate to some multinational bank like J.P. Morgan or Citicorp or something like that. Now, I've asked the question several times, well, where is this? Now, Larry Beecraft comes up and says, well, now, I researched out Title 42, Section 301 through 335 and the amendments to the Social Security Act, and it isn't in there. Sometimes people come here and they say there's no place in the U.S. Code that defines or gives a definition for income. Now, I don't know that that's true. I know that a number of courts have explained what income is. And when you come to tax school here, I cite Diefendorf versus Golay at 51 Idaho back in 1932, where the Supreme Court of Idaho lays out with specificity the definition of income. So, I have never read all of Title 26 of the U.S. Code. I don't mind telling you that I'm a law school teacher. I teach law. I have never read all of it. I've not read every word. And it's too big for me. I mean, maybe, you know, somebody out there can read that whole thing, but that's way beyond my ability or capacity. That's a lot of books. In fact, I don't know how many. I can't see it from right here, but I'm looking at the U.S. Code. And I would say that Title 26 has at least 10, maybe 15, could even have 20 volumes just in the tax code. So when I hear somebody say to me, well, there's no place in Title 26 that defines income, I have to ask the question, have you read all of Title 26? I've never met anybody that's ever read all of Title 26. I never met a lawyer. Never met a politician. Hell, your politicians passed the whole Patriot Act, 1,300 pages, never read it. And those are your lawmakers. They don't even read the laws before they enact them. What in the hell would make you think they read those laws after they enact them? Now, let me ask the killer question here. If you've never read Title 26, then how do you know that there's no place in Title 26 that defines income? The courts have, on several occasions, they've defined it. It may be that the Supreme Court justices have read all of Title 26. There may even be some tax accountant out there or some CPA that maybe has read the whole thing. But I don't know of anybody that has. And so, here again, people come to conclusions that are based upon assumed facts or facts that aren't in evidence, or in this case here, just blatant misrepresentation. You don't know that Title 26 doesn't define income. But I would give you your argument. I'd say, well, hell, maybe it doesn't. But that doesn't mean that income isn't defined by some other source, such as the U.S. Supreme Court or the Supreme Court of Idaho, which I do know about, and I have read those cases. I can read Diefendorf. It's, you know, five or six pages. I can handle that. It's these, you know, 15 or 20 volumes that I can't handle. All right, now, this Treasury direct account over here, then, is something that a lot of people believe in, and they're out espousing that, and they're telling people about it, and you've got the $630,000 in here. And what they're doing is they're appealing to your lust and greed, because that's what you want to hear, and you're going to believe whatever you want to hear. If you don't like what I'm telling you, then you'll just tune out and you won't listen. So, but then I'm not trying to persuade you that I'm right and you're wrong. So if you thought that I was trying to convince you of something over here, you got the wrong idea. That's not my modus operandi. So here I am telling you, this is the report that I'm giving you here based upon my personal experience with four of my students that tested it and all four lost. Here's Larry Beecraft. He walks in the door. He says, okay, I'm going to actually identify six flaws to this whole concept, which is what we're doing right here. I've covered 1, 2, 3, 4. This is number 5. This Treasury Direct account is something that really does exist. But these gurus now, they've taken that and they have applied it to something, birth certificates and Social Security accounts or Social Security numbers, off point and out of context. That doesn't exist. Taint there. All right, now, that being the case, if I'm wrong and it does appear and it is there in Title 42, Section 301 through 335, the Social Security Act, would you please point that out to me? You know, send me an email and say, hey, wait a minute, Gordon, you know, you need a little help and I'm going to help you here. Here's where it's located. This is your Treasury Direct account and here's where it's used. This $630,000, can you show me where that account is? Can you give me a sample account number? Can you, in short, prove the positive side of your argument? Beecraft has to come in here and prove it doesn't exist, which I think he's done an adequate job. But on the other hand, the real burden of proof is on you. That's where it really lies. All right, now the sixth argument here, or the sixth fatal flaw, you cannot write sight drafts on the Treasury of the United States by way of this non-existent account. So here's an account that you believe you have called a Treasury Direct account. You believe it's got $630,000 in it. And then you want to write sight drafts on that Treasury account because you actually have the number. Now, the four guys that I told you about that came down here to class, they actually had a number. And when I sent that sight draft off to a banker friend of mine, he said, God, that is good. That is a good swindle. That is a good fraud. They actually have. He said, if this is the Department of Transportation account number, they have opened Pandora's box. They actually have the Holy Grail. And they're not supposed to have that. That only belongs, you know, to the Department of Transportation. And the average Joe Sixpack out here ain't supposed to have that. Now, remember the Montana Freemen up here? They were writing these sight drafts, and they got put in prison for that. And Beecraft has identified a bunch of other people here in his destroyed arguments section here of his treatise. And he says, hey, these cases were all losers. And I'm telling you about four cases that I'm directly associated with, and they were all losers. So we don't know of any winning cases. Now, let me put this little caveat in here. When I expose something like this, especially if I do it over the air, people really get upset with me, and they write me letters, and they just really castigate me, you know, for being holier than thou and being trying to be a smart ass. And so I'm here to tell you, listen, this isn't the first time you've ever been deceived, partner, and it won't be the last. And I've been wrong before, and Larry Beecraft has been wrong or in error and made mistakes before, and it's humiliating. None of us like to be, you know, found out that we were wrong or that we made a mistake, but hey, it's part of the learning curve, you know, it's part of life. Wake up and smell the coffee. Sometimes we make mistakes. Okay, so now I've been straightened out, now I can see that that was incorrect. That doesn't mean that everything that you know now is faulty. It just means that this one little item over here is not true. You know, probably 90% of what you believe is true, accurate, and correct, but you got 10% of this error. The 10% of the error mixed with the 90% truth is going to lead you to prison. Let's get rid of the 10% error here. Let's get off this redemption crap, because that's just what it is, just so much crap. Last item, and he says here, you cannot write sight drafts on the Treasury of the United States. Now, if you send any such site drafts to anyone, you will be prosecuted for violation of 18 U.S.C. 514, which provides as follows. Fictitious obligations. Whoever, with the intent to defraud, draws, prints, processes, produces, publishes, or otherwise makes or attempts to cause the same within the United States, passes, utters, presents, offers, brokers, issues, sells, or attempts or causes the same, or with like intent possesses within the United States or utilizes interstate or foreign commerce, including the use of the mails or wire, radio, or other electronic communication, to transmit, transport, ship, move, transfer, attempts, or causes the same to, from, or through the United States, any false or fictitious instrument, document, or other item appearing, representing, purporting, or contriving through scheme or artifice to be an actual security or other financial instrument issued under the authority of the United States, a foreign government, a state, or other political subdivision of the United States, or an organization shall be guilty of a Class B felony. So this is a felony. Could put you in prison for 25 years, he says here, didn't it? I think it's 25 years, he said. And, yeah, it says violations of this statute provide for a maximum period of 25 years in imprisonment. And that's where this floor layer was. You see, he'd already gone out and made these two checks, maybe made more than that, I don't know. They looked good. He made them on his own computer. And notice that it's an instrument. It's a false weight. It's an unjust weight or balance. Now, remember in the scripture, God tells us, don't use these unjust weights or balances. Federal Reserve notes are unjust weights and balances. Sight drafts, checks, credit cards are all unjust weights and balances. We should be using gold and silver coin. We should be using wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. We should be dealing in substance, dealing in property. We should be dealing in increase, not income. We should be dealing in property, not profit. And that's where we get into trouble. Now, government comes along and taxes this profit and income. That's where your income tax comes. It comes from dealing in profit instead of property. And income instead of increase. God wants his tithe on your increase. And he doesn't want you to practice unjust weights and balances. He tells you so very plainly. Thou shalt not steal. And in Leviticus 19, 35 and 36 and Deuteronomy 25, 13 through 16. Tells you don't use these unjust weights and balances. Now, of course, we're all smarter than God. And so we come along and we use these instruments, these commercial paper instruments. And that's where the income tax comes in. The income tax isn't on property, isn't now, hasn't been, isn't going to be. Property is not taxed, it's profit. I'll cover that a little later. Now, for purposes of this section, any term used in this section that is defined in Section 513C has the same meaning given such term in Section 513C. And the United States Secret Service, in addition to any other agency having such authority, shall have authority to investigate offenses under this section, and violations of this statute provide for a maximum period of 25 years imprisonment. Now, a friend of mine from Kuskokwim, Idaho, attended a meeting where Jack Smith of Wrong Way Law, now this is, actually it isn't called Wrong Way Law, Jack Smith calls his Patriot school or whatever he's doing there, he calls it Right Way Law. And he used to work with a guy named Rick Schramm. When I knew him, it was Jack Smith and Rick Schramm. And they were out here peddling this poppycock. And Rick Schramm went to school here at the law school. And so Rick Schramm has a lot of my material, and he goes out and he perverts it. He has perverted it and used it to his own use. And then said, well, I got that from George Gordon. See, I went to the Gordon Law School. Now, let's take Richard Nixon, for instance. Now, Richard Nixon went to law school. I don't know what law school he went. I think he went to Whittier College or something like that, some small college out in California. But he was a lawyer. He must have gone to law school someplace. So let's just pick a law school. It could be that he went to the Harvard Law School. Or the Yale Law School. Now, let's suppose, for the sake of our discussion, that Richard Nixon, who was later discredited in the Watergate scandal and resigned as president over here. Remember one time he said, "I'm not a crook," indicating that he hadn't broken any laws and that he wasn't in violation of any laws here. And let's suppose, for the sake of our discussion here, he graduated from the Harvard Law School. Would you say that now that we have discovered that Richard Nixon was a famous crook, and that he was out breaking the law, and that he was guilty of perjury, that he'd lied, and lied under oath, would you say that he learned that at the Harvard Law School, and then would you blame the law school for having turned out that crook? Because a lot of people go to law school, and then, based upon what they've learned there, they go out and they break a lot of laws, and they're criminals. And they're really paid professional criminals, you know, like Bill Clinton and his wife. I mean, those two have law school degrees, and they've gone out. Now, they haven't been convicted, see. But they're out here breaking the law. And you can't catch them at it because they're real professionals. See, they can catch small fish like you and me because, you know, we're just little guys down here, and we don't know near as much law as we think we do. But then when these guys get up to be president of the United States, you know, and they get in, they're pretty crafty. And then they also have a little help from the insiders also. But that doesn't mean that the professors at the Harvard Law School are turning out criminals, because some of the lawyers that they turn out actually go out and do criminal acts. So just because somebody's been to law school here at the law school and they tell you, "Hey, I learned that from George Gordon," don't you believe that for a minute. It may be that they did. It may be that they did not. And remember, I'm not there to tell you, "Well, that's not what we teach. That's not what we practice." Now, a lot of times people will say that I'm a tax protester. Well, I'm here to tell you that I'm not, and I'm not protesting any tax. I'm not trying to overthrow the IRS, not trying to abolish the Federal Reserve. Heaven forbid. The people of America like the Federal Reserve. They want more of it. They can't get enough paper. The people of America want the income tax, as was evidenced in the 1992 and 1906 and the year 2000 elections. Three elections, the people of America had an opportunity to turn away from the income tax. They could have voted for Ross Perot, and they didn't. They could have voted in Steve Forbes twice in 1996 and 2000. They didn't do that. Now, that sends me a pretty strong message. When the choice between a flat tax, which is what Forbes was proposing, the abolition of the income tax, and in fact, we even had another choice here the other day. In 2008, there was a guy running for office by the name of Ron Paul, and he's been advocating the abolition of the income tax and the Federal Reserve and the restoration of gold and silver in our monetary system. And the people of America have consistently voted from at least 1992 through 2008. And with one exception in 2004, I don't know that you had an income tax candidate, maybe the Libertarian candidate, but I mean in the major parties, the Republicans and Democrats. Now, you've had a choice in 1992, 1996, 2000, and 2008. And Americans have consistently voted for the income tax and for the Federal Reserve. And so who am I to come in here and tell you people that you shouldn't have that? And I'm not protesting that process. I'm not participating in it. I'm not advocating it. That's true. But I'm not protesting it either. I am an informer. I just come along and tell you, "Well, here's your choices. You know, do what you want to do, but here's what God tells you that we should be doing and we're not. And here's what your government tells you that you should be doing, and here's your God that tells you, no, you ought not to be doing that." And then you people go out there and make your own choices in life. All right, now as it relates to this accepted for value redemption straw man, UCC 1-207, redemption, redemption process, site drafts, affidavits of truth in commerce, and so on. And there's probably some more terms over here that I haven't covered. But when you run into that, be aware of the fact that it's a loser, and that the people that have used that have lost, such as Kent Hovind, or Kent Hovind, however you pronounce his last name, has said that he subscribed to it, and he made that observation a number of times in his tapes that I have here, and from what I understand, he used that in his tax evasion case, and he lost. Now, if you want to use it in your tax evasion case, well, go ahead. That's your choice in life. But now I've given you the report, and I said it didn't work in any cases that I've been associated with. And Larry Beecraft said it hadn't worked in any cases that he knows about or he's been associated with. And our challenge to you is, why don't you produce some winning cases over here so that we can contrast this? All right, we're at the halfway point. I have to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. Remember, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the law school, or the Law Hour, rather, the website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. And these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. A word here about our free general law CD package. We send those out about 3 or 4 times a year. And so, you know, I sent these out here about 2 or 3 months ago, it's time to send out another batch. I got a big pile of requests there. A lot of times somebody will call me up and they'll say, where in the hell is this free package you're going to send me? I called you last week and haven't got it yet. Well, that's because we don't send those out every day. And we don't send them out every week either. This is not the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association with hundreds of hot and cold running secretaries darting around the office shipping the stuff out, you know, by return mail. Now, this is me, my wife, and my son Dirk, and there's 3 of us here. And on top of that, we're old, you know, so you got these old farts over here. And then on top of that, we're all lazy. So you got these lazy old farts on top of it. And so far, in 25 years, we've always sent them out, but we don't send them out as rapidly as many of you would like, I suppose. So just be patient with me. I'm old and full of years. Now, that concludes my little program here on these accepted for value redemption straw man UCC-1-07. So I'm done with that. But now, Larry Beecraft has number 17 here. Can I find it? Yeah, here it is. He has about 25 of these articles or subjects in here. And he talks about implementing regulations. Taxes are contractual. Simple facts regarding the we are subjects of the British Crown issue. Filing 1099s against IRS agents, land patents, the UCC argument, I covered that one. The IMF argument, non-resident aliens and so on. There's a lot of subject matters that run around out here in patriot circles. And the people that subscribe to them, and indeed the people that are selling them or promoting them, believe them. I mean, I'm sure they believe them. Even if it's just a theory, I'm sure that Jack Smith believes his theory. Roger Elvick believes his theory. And the tragedy of this theory thing is that a lot of people get convicted of crimes or they lose their property or their businesses. I remember so well a man called me from Fort Worth, Texas, on the income tax issue. And he had a small business and I don't know, 50 employees or something like that. And he thought the income tax was unconstitutional or some such argument. And he stopped withholding. He didn't withhold from his employees. He just gave his employees their full checks. He contracted with them for $10 an hour, and he paid them $10 an hour. He did not withhold their Social Security and so on. Well, he called here about a month or two before he was indicted. And he and some other businessmen had taken up this challenge. And I don't think that they had very much legal education or legal understanding. There is certainly a way for you to do this. This is a direct confrontation to the law. And, of course, if you're wrong, well, then you have to pay the consequences. Now, the man was prosecuted. He was convicted and jailed for tax evasion and so on. And I told him that was the ultimate outcome. That was what's going to happen to him. And, of course, he didn't listen to me, but he got in with me kind of toward the end. He'd already been committed, you know, for 4 or 5 years prior to that. And I don't know how this redemption thing fit into his thinking or into his planning. But I always felt bad about that. And I do to this day when I hear people, they call me. Oftentimes people call here after they've been convicted and they're in between the conviction and the sentencing, which at this juncture of time, there's not much I can do. There's not much that you can do. I mean, you need to be educated before you do this. You need to be a Rosa Parks who played what we call the part of the goat. But her defense was well thought out before she ever committed the crime. So if you're going to commit the crime, then you have to be prepared to do the time. You need to be well-versed in your defense. And there might be, other than a direct confrontation, there might be another way for you to test this. Maybe a declaratory judgment might be a more intelligent modality for moving forward here, or some other form of extraordinary relief. I want to take up another subject here that Larry Beecraft touches upon. In number 17, he says, taxes are contractual. Citing McLaughlin versus CIR, Circuit Court, I believe it is, 832 Fed 2nd, 986, 7th Circuit, 1987, he says, this argument was held to be without merit. That is, when you come into tax court or you come into federal district court and you're arguing that your income tax or that your connection with the income tax is based upon a contract or that it's contractual. And then Beecraft says, now that this argument has or was held to be without merit. The notion that the federal income tax is contractual or otherwise consensual in nature is not only utterly without foundation, but has been repeatedly rejected by the courts. Now, Bernard Sussman has a collection of cases involving parties who raised this contract argument, and you may study those cases by clicking here. So, if you went to the Beecraft website and you got this treatise from flyhighway.net, and then you went to this number 17, taxes are contractual, it's just a paragraph here, just a short statement, in which Beecraft says, the notion that the federal income tax is contractual or otherwise consensual in nature is not only utterly without foundation, but has been repeatedly rejected by the courts. I dissent from that conclusion or that opinion. I believe that the income tax is contractual. In spite of what Larry says here, I think that it is contractual, and furthermore, I think I can prove it. Now, Larry and I, over the years, have had some discussions concerning some legal theories in which he's taken one side and I've taken the other. And I'm sure that he's sincere in his observation, just as I am. But I wanted to take up a subject or two here in the concluding portion of this series of programs over here, and to the people who have brought up the subject of redemption, what they're suggesting here is that there's this secret, that there's, here's what the law is, but you're not being told that. And it's kept under wraps, and that the real secret over here is something different. Okay. There is some merit to that, and I subscribe to that. I believe that that's true. And we're called conspiracy theorists for believing that. And I'm one of those conspiracy theorists. And primarily because I don't believe that what you see going on around you worldwide can happen accidentally all the time, that it requires direction. Now, when the statement is made, the notion that the federal income tax is contractual or otherwise consensual in nature is not only without foundation, but has been repeatedly rejected by the courts. There's two sides to the story here, two sides to the coin. You see, there are people who have a contract. It's called Social Security. Social Security is a contract. So let's start our discussion by analyzing, well, what is a contract? Because when you look in Bouvier's Law Dictionary at the word license, it says plainly that a license is not a contract. And when you look at Social Security, all of the legal authorities tell you that Social Security is not a contract. And I disagree. I believe that a license is a contract. And I believe that Social Security is a licensing contract. See? So, I'm at loggerheads here with the establishment, the Bouvier Law Dictionary, and with all of the pundits over here. And I'm going to tell you why right now. So, gather around here, boys and girls, and I'll show you what's going on here. And there's two sides to this coin, and I don't think we're getting both sides of it. Number one. A contract has four elements to it. Four elements. Go look up the word contract in the dictionary, and you'll find that it's an offer. It's made up of some thingies here. So you have an offer. That's the first thing that occurs in a contract. The salesman comes up with an offer. Or you'll look at an ad on TV. It says, come into Happy Harry's Used Cars today. We're offering this car here for this amount of money. No money down and $300 a month. All right, so you go into Happy Harry's, and you have to accept the offer. You have to say, God, I like that car. I want to buy it. So he's offering to sell it, and you're offering to buy it. Okay, that's two. So you have an offer with an acceptance. But that's not a contract. We haven't got there yet. Now there has to be some considerations. So he says, well, I want $300 a month payments. Okay. Now we've got an offer with acceptance with consideration, but that's still not a contract. We have to spell out the time. Now, if we have an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration, now we have a contract. Now, let's apply that to your driver's license. You got a license, which the dictionary says, well, by definition, is not a contract, but you have an offer by the state. You go down to the licensing agency and you accept it. So there's an offer with an acceptance. And there has to be consideration, and they charge you a fee. And then there has to be a time, and the licensing period is 4 years, or until your birthday 4 years from now, or some other such time element. Now, there's four elements. Now, that's why I contend that a license, while it's a special type of license, it's an adhesion contract. If you'll look up the word contract, and if you'll look up adhesion, you'll see that there's a thing here called an adhesion contract. I've talked about that a number of times. I may even do it again. All right, so that's number one. Now, this Social Security account is just exactly that. There's no requirement, there's no law that requires you to get a Social Security number or a Social Security account. Now, nearly everybody in this country has it. You people in Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, and Western Europe, hell, you all have these Social Security accounts. These are retirement accounts. These accounts give you access to unemployment insurance and workman's compensation and all these social benefits, the social net that is so popular in all socialist countries. And it's done by contract. You don't have to do that. My boy Dirk has never had a Social Security number from the day he was born until today. And he makes his living. He lives his life. He doesn't have one, never has had one. Most of us have had one in the past and then rescinded it and no longer use it or the benefits derived therefrom. We have rescinded the contract. And if you'll look in Bouvier's Law Dictionary, there's a section on rescission of contract. R-E-S-C-I-S-S-I-O-N, rescission of contract. All right. You understand that so far? So, number one, I believe, that licenses are contracts, and they're a different class of contracts from what belong to ordinary contracts, but they are, in fact, offers with acceptances over time with consideration. Now, you can deny it, and you can say, well, no, that's not a contract. I certainly wouldn't go into court and argue that the license is a contract, because the judge isn't going to hear that. So, when you go into court and you want to make a defense to income tax, you certainly wouldn't want to walk in there and say, these taxes are contractual, and so therefore I don't owe this tax because it's a contract, because the courts have rejected that as a defense. And so I think Beecraft is on point, and his point is well taken. But that does not mean that taxes are not contractual. Now, I'm not paying the income tax. Let's see if I get an audit now. Now, here's what I did, so you can follow along. I rescinded my Social Security account number, which is my taxpayer identification number. I don't know if you knew this or understood it or not, but since 1964, Congress has made your Social Security number your taxpayer ID number. All right, those two go together. And so I looked at that and said, gee, maybe Social Security has something to do with the income tax. I mean, they didn't use my driver's license number, you know, as my taxpayer ID number. So there might be something there. Now, Social Security is a contract because I went down to the Social Security office and said I'd like to join up, and the lady said there's qualifications, and so when I met those qualifications, the government has an offer. They would like to give you a Social Security number. They'd like you to come in and get one. So I go down there and say, well, I'd like to accept your offer. And they say, well, now you've got to pay some consideration, and the consideration is 16.1% of what I earn on the job. I agree that I will pay this rate, or 15.3% if I'm self-employed. And then over time, well, as long as I'm working in the workplace. So the time frame lasts from the day I take a job until the day I quit. So you have an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration, and that's why I believe that Social Security is a contract. I mean, you can call it whatever you want there, kids, but that's what it appears like to me. Now, in California, we don't call skunks skunks. We call them civet cats, and I was corrected, you know. I said, my God, that smells like a skunk, and this guy said, no, that's not a skunk, that's a civet cat. Well, okay, for you Californians out there, they're civet cats, but for the rest of us in the country, those little animals, those little black and white animals that smell real bad, are called skunks everywhere else in America, except California, to my knowledge. All right, so now that tells you that part of the story. Now, I'm not paying the income tax, so I don't have a Social Security number, and I'm not paying the income tax, and that's because I'm avoiding income like AIDS, herpes, and VD. Now, I think we might have a different story here. If without a Social Security number and I was out here working and making income, I think I would owe an income tax. But let's try it this way. Let's suppose, for the sake of our discussion here, that you, for whatever reason, have decided that you do not want to pay the income tax anymore. You don't want to file any more 1040 forms. Now, the tax protesters, you know, the patriot groups are telling you, well, the income tax is voluntary. I think they're correct. And I think that when you signed up for Social Security, you volunteered. And I think everybody who has a Social Security account number is a taxpayer. And the courts have said that everybody who's a citizen of the United States is a taxpayer. All right, so in Chapter 5 of my Tax and Status School, there's a lady by the name of Rachel Templeton. Nice lady, I'm sure. You know, Rachel was a nice lady. See Chapter 4 here, and we get Rachel Templeton. Yeah, the Rachel Templeton case. And there's another connecting link here. And the court said, finally, we address Templeton's second argument in which she claims that she's not a person liable or a taxpayer, as those terms are defined by the Internal Revenue Code and the relevant case law, and as a result that the provisions of Section 6103 do not apply in her case. So we agree with the district court that this claim is patently frivolous, as Templeton does not dispute that she is a citizen of the United States, and because the code imposes an income tax on every individual who is a citizen or resident of the United States. So you would be a taxpayer owing this income tax if you were a citizen or a resident or if you had income. You could be a non-resident alien and owe income tax on income if you had income. Now, let's try this out for size nut. What if you weren't a citizen, you weren't a resident, you didn't have any income, and you didn't have a Social Security number? Now would you owe the income tax? Now, think about this for a minute. Now, the courts have said if you're a citizen, you're a taxpayer. If you're a resident, you're a taxpayer. If you got income, you're a taxpayer. You owe a tax. And if you got a Social Security account number, that's your taxpayer identification number. What if we eliminated all those? What if we expatriated our citizenship, became residents of some foreign jurisdiction, stopped having income, and resigned our Social Security numbers? Then would we owe an income tax? Would we then be taxpayers? And it's my contention that the answer is no. No. Furthermore, did you know that the Bible prohibits citizenship in your country? It's called idolatry and violates the first commandment. And in fact, in Revelation 18, verse 4, your Creator tells you to come out of her, my people, that you be not partakers of her sin. Residence is purely voluntary and determined by you personally. Where did you want to be a resident? Go look it up in Bouvier. It's a pretty long article on residency. And then income. What is income? I'll talk about income here as we progress along from Diefendorf versus Galay. But income is something. If you want to know what income is, it's something. Write it down. I'm telling you, right out of the Supreme Court of Idaho. When somebody says, Mr. Gordon, can you tell me what income is? I tell them, absolutely, I can tell you what income is. Now, I'm telling all of you right now. Write it down. Income is something. S-O-M-E-T-H-I-N-G. Income is something. That's the definition of it. Comes right out of Diefendorf versus Collet. That's one source. Now there's Schaefer versus Carter, tells you a little bit more. Now, I'll talk about this something here in greater detail as we progress along. Now, labor. You go to work for General Motors or General Electric, and you're working away here, see? And you signed on at General Motors, and the labor union says they're going to pay you $10 an hour, okay? Now, you work 40 hours. Test it. Go look at your paycheck. There's a stub on your paycheck, and it says you worked 40 hours. And that your pay rate is, and they'll put your pay scale down there, depending upon where you are in the union era hierarchy. You got a pay scale, say it's $10 an hour. Well, 10 times 40 is $400. Now, take a look at your net pay. You got a little block there that says net pay. And it's something less than $400. Now, hell, even you people that have been to public school, for crying out loud, can multiply $10 an hour times 40 hours and come up with $400, can't you? Now, take a look at your net pay. Isn't that something less than $400? All right. It's $310. What happened to that $90? Huh? Now, it's obvious that you have been taxed. In fact, they got little squares there, and it says income tax, Social Security tax, Medicare tax, all these various taxes and all these deductions over there. Now, where did the government get the power to take that $90 out of there? Because there's other people that are working for General Motors, and they're working for $10 an hour, and they're getting paid the whole $400. And those people are called consultants. Those people are called contract labor. Now, why is it that General Motors is paying the contract labor or the consultant differently than they're paying you? Has it occurred to you that you've got some kind of a contract or some kind of an agreement here? Do you know where that contract or that agreement is located? Do you know why that little square says FICA deduction? You know what that FICA means? So when I hear somebody say that Social Security is not a contract, and then you're working for this outfit over here, well, then it's either you got a contract and they're performing pursuant to your agreement with them, and there may be more than two parties to the contract. This contract may involve more than just you and General Motors. It may be you, the union, General Motors, the United States of America, and Michigan. There may be five parties to this contract, and there is. But you've got a contract, and Social Security is a contract, and they're taking that $90 out of there under the terms of the contract. Well, it's either that or they're stealing it, one or the other. So which is it? Are they stealing it from you? I don't think they're stealing it from you. I think that you agreed to that deduction, and I think that you agree to it every week, and that that deduction is being used for some benefit, something that benefits you at some later date, maybe at retirement, maybe when you're unemployed, maybe when you're disabled, break a leg on the job or something like that. All right. So that's why I think that we're dealing with contract here. Now, I'm not through with this, and we'll take this up next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review when we're talking about this thing of contracts. Is the income tax contractual? And I say the answer is yes. Now I got to give you a final reminder that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.